Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear oral argument in National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania versus Dominguez. The petitioner and the respondent will each be given 20 minutes to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a part of that time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Mr. Brent Cooper will present argument to the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this case involves an appeal from a bad faith workers' compensation case. The principal issue, which I believe is addressed in this case, is the standard by which this court or the courts of appeals or the trial court are to determine the existence of a reasonable basis for denial or delay in payment of a claim. There are four areas that I'd like to address in the oral argument. They are as follows. First is the background of the rules creating the duty of good faith and fair dealing in the workers' compensation context. Second, I'd like to use the facts in this case to demonstrate the problems that currently exist under Texas law today as far as an insurance carrier trying to make a determination as to whether or not to pay a claim. Third, I'd like to set out the rule that petitioner believes this court should adopt. And finally, demonstrate to this court the benefits flowing from that rule, which we believe should be adopted. As this court is well aware, we've had bad faith or duty of good faith and fair dealing for workers' compensation cases since 1988 in the Aranda case. And there are two primary elements that must be established by the claimant in order to prevail in their claim. First one is the absence of a reasonable basis for denying or delaying payment of benefits under the policy. And second, that the carrier knew or should have known that there was not a reasonable basis for denying the claim or delaying payment. And that's the first element that we believe is crucial to the court's determination in this case, and that is the absence of a reasonable basis. This court in the Aranda decision said that the first element is an objective test. It's objective. What a reasonable insurance carrier under the same or similar circumstances would have done. Would they have paid it? Would they have delayed? Or were they not have paid? So we know from the Aranda decision, it's an objective test. Now, second, in the Aranda decision, this court built in certain safeguards. The court said that carriers will maintain the right to deny invalid or questionable claims and not be subject to liability for erroneous denial of a claim. Now, this was protection that was built in to insurance carriers for the claims that are questionable. Now, it's our belief and it's our position that because of the lack of standards that exist as far as determination of whether or not there's a reasonable basis or not a reasonable basis, this protection basically is unavailable to insurance carriers in the state of Texas. No greater example of the problem, I believe, exists than the facts in this case. Very briefly, as this court has decided or determined earlier, for example, in the Biles decision, one of the things you look at as far as whether or not a carrier has acted in good faith is what they had available to them at the time the decision was made. In this case, the evidence that was introduced in the underlying trial showed, first off, the issue was whether or not this individual's claim was work-related. That was the key determination. That was the focus by the carrier in the investigation of this case. The carrier in the underlying case focused on the employment records, and in this case, there had been no report of an on-the-job injury. There had been a long-term disability benefit request by the claimant, who in fact represented to his employer that it was not work-related, because if it was work-related, he couldn't receive the long-term disability benefits. He collected the long-term disability benefits until they ran out, at which time he went back to work, and he worked for about 2 months. Then he was either quit or was fired, depending upon whose story you believe. And it was not until after he was terminated that the workers' compensation claim was eventually filed. The insurance carrier in this case also had the medical records. The medical records indicated that the plaintiff told Dr. Zay and Dr. Driscoll that the condition that he was complaining of had been experienced for at least 4 years before the time of the alleged injury. He told Dr. Palifax in January of 1986, shortly before he retained an attorney, that the work or that he had not reported the injury to the employer. And finally, he told Dr. Palifax that the injury was not job-related. We had the employer's E1, which the employer, Teddy Gray in this case, determined or stated that there had been no on-the-job injury reported to them during any of the periods that this individual was employed by Teddy Gray. We had the plaintiff's notice of injury, which was not filed until some 10 months after the alleged accident and 1 month after the termination of the plaintiff's employment. Finally, we had health claims that were filed with the health insurer for Teddy Gray, Aetna in this case. And on at least two or three occasions, health claims were filed for medical treatment for this condition, which he represented to the health carrier that this was not work-related. And again, he would not be entitled to those benefits if the injury was work-related. So we see a trail of at least some confusion. Confusion caused by the plaintiff himself. He repeatedly says it wasn't work-related. There are some documents that say it was work-related. So the carrier had this information, this trail of information created by the plaintiff himself, and so what did they try to do? One step was, let's talk to the plaintiff. Let's ask him, why did you say it wasn't work-related when now you're claiming it was work-related? A request was made by the insurance carrier in this case to the attorney representing Mr. Dominguez for a written statement where we could talk to him, ask him these questions, ask him to explain the discrepancies as far as the medical records, the employment records, and the other records. The carrier in this case was refused, was told they could not talk to the plaintiff. In fact, we're not allowed. So in this case, the plaintiff takes two or three different positions. The physician reports go both ways. We ask the insured for a statement to clarify it. What's the insurer to do? We delayed payment in this claim until after the IAB made their award and it was appealed by the plaintiff. And based on this record, we were hit with $300,000 verdict by the jury. It's our position that absent a standard, the protection afforded by Aranda essentially is meaningless. Now, this court is not the first time this court has had the opportunity to address the standard to be applied in a duty of good faith and fair dealing case. There have been some warning shots fired by this court earlier, as far back as 1983 in the English versus Fisher case, where Justice Wallace pointed out some of the dangers that were attendant to adopting the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Wallace, in that case, Justice Wallace said, one danger in adopting such a duty is that it would abolish our system of government according to settled rules of law and let each case be decided upon what might seem fair and in good faith to the trier of fact. And what he was talking about was that we've got to have some standards for the court, for the trial courts, for the courts of appeals in order to gauge this conduct and not have it some amorphous standard in which carriers, insurance carriers, for example, can plot their conduct and determine their conduct according to these standards. It's our position that there currently is an absence of any standard to guide insurance carriers in the state regarding the duty of good faith and fair dealing, and we're asking this court today to adopt the standard to guide trial courts, courts of appeals, also to give predictability to the litigants and to the insurance carriers in this state. Now, the standard that we're asking this court to adopt today is the directed verdict on the contract standard. This is a standard that has been adopted by several courts across the country. I guess the most prominent is the Alabama court, and the leading case is in our brief, National Savings Life versus Dutton. And basically that standard holds that an insurer has a reasonable basis to deny claim if the evidence is such that it would survive a motion for directed verdict. And we believe that this test serves the interest of the insurance carriers, it serves the interest of the claimants in a workers' compensation context, and also it serves the interest of the courts, trial courts, and the courts of appeals. Why should Texas adopt this standard? Well, first, it provides a definitive standard for the trial court and courts of appeals as far as measuring conduct of insurance carriers. It also provides some measure of predictability to the insurers as well as the claimants in this state. Second, we also know it's a workable standard because trial courts and courts of appeals deal with this standard on a daily basis. It's something they're familiar with. We also know that in the cases I believe are cited on pages 13 through 17 of our original application, some courts have already applied this standard. Now, they've not articulated it as such, but in essence, that some Texas courts have already applied the standards to facts before them.
Counsel, what difference would it make if we had the standard in this case or not?
Well,
if it remains the case, we had to the jury found bad faith on evidence, you've argued. So what difference does it make whether or not we have the standard in this case?
Well, it would never get to the jury if the court is charged with a determination of whether or not there is a reasonable basis. See, that's one, Justice Gonzalez, that's one of the problems in this case, is the jury, it's basically, as Justice Wallace has warned, they're deciding what's fair. And the jury, for example, whether or not there is a reasonable basis for a claim involves questions of law. It involves an evaluation of the evidence. For example, in a directive verdict standard, a trial court, if he's looking at that, has to go through several review processes, such as you can't stack inferences. Juries don't know about that. You can't draw an inference from another inference. Juries don't know about that. You can't have your expert testimony must be based upon well-established methodology. All of these types of issues the jury is totally unaware of. And
on what basis do you think your client was entitled to a direct verdict in this case?
Because there existed a reasonable basis for denial or delay in payment of this claim, that is the insurer or the claimant's own statements that this was not work-related. He collected for 5 months benefits representing to his employer that this wasn't work-related.
Doesn't that routinely happen in these kinds of cases where there's differences in testimony about the nature and extent of injury and whether it happened at home or at work? I mean, isn't that not an exceptional case to that extent, is it?
Well, I will say that how often this occurs, but as a matter of fact, if his statements that he made to his employer, if the statements that were made to the physicians, if the statements that were made to the health care were true, and these are statements made by the plaintiff, we don't have to pay because it was not work-related. If you believe these numerous statements that were made by the plaintiff in this case.
I presume he had an alternative explanation.
Well, his explanation was, again, he was mistaken. But again, that brings us back to the point of the Viles decision, and that is you've got to look at what the insurance company had at the time the decision was made to deny the claim or delay payment. The opportunity to have him testify again wasn't achieved until the case went to trial. The request for an oral statement, a recorded statement, was refused by counsel for the insured in this case.
Are you abandoning your argument that the agreed judgment and the language of the agreed judgment, you know, in some way validates your claim that this was a...
Well, that goes to our collateral estoppel and judicial estoppel issues.
Are you abandoning that argument?
No, we're not abandoning that argument at all. We believe that those are valid as well. I believe they're probably more properly addressed by the bridge. I'll be happy to address them for the court if the court would like. But I believe that one of the critical issues in this case, again, involves a lot of public policy regarding the standard to be applied. I think the law with respect to collateral estoppel, judicial estoppel, is fairly well crystallized. We've had these doctrines around numerous years, and the courts have taken them, they fine-tuned them, and the litigants pretty much know what's collateral estoppel and what's not collateral estoppel. But I don't think we have that with respect to the duty of good faith and fair dealing. We're still in its infancy. It's my position and the position of my client that there is some further fine-tuning that's needed, particularly the standard to be applied as far as the conduct of the insurer. And again, that's why we believe the directed verdict standard is needed. You look at also what's involved. In essence, you're asking the insurance company, if you have a disputed claim, a questionable claim, basically they're being asked to roll the dice. And if they decide to roll the dice, and they decide to go ahead and employ their constitutionally protected right to a trial by jury, if they lose, they're punished. In this case, there is a punishment for an insurance carrier exercising its constitutionally protected right to a trial by jury, absent any standards. Because if they decide to go ahead and submit it to a jury, and it turns out they lose, then sure enough, they're going to have a second lawsuit. And that's pretty clear now that there will be a second lawsuit for bad faith. And if there are no standards, there's a total lack of predictability as far as whether or not they would or would not be held liable. And we believe, again, that this constitutes a punishment for an insurer exercising the right to trial by jury. Let's look at what this court has done in other situations where there was a possible punishment of a party for exercising its right to a trial by jury.
Counsel, before you do that, may I
sure.
ask a question? How would this differ by analogy from the pre-Burke royalty standard of where if the defendant could establish some care, it could avoid punitive damages altogether?
There you get the entire want of care, so if the defendant could come forward with some care, then basically the question was, you know, did he, I guess, erase the finding of the plaintiff? Well, three reasons, I believe. First off, in Burke royalty, we were talking about a standard of review by an appellate court. In this case, we're not talking about a standard of review. We're talking about the standard to govern the conduct of the insurer. Second, in Burke royalty, there was no penalty for the exercise of a party's right to a trial by jury. And third, the point that I was coming to is, even ignoring those, we've already got Burke royalty as far as statutes or decisions that punish a party's exercise of the right to trial by jury. We already have Burke royalty. If you look at the DTPA, Article 21.21, the bad faith counterclaim that exists in there, this court in Donworth said if there is any evidence to support the claim of the plaintiff, it doesn't even have to be admissible evidence. If the plaintiff can come forward with some evidence, no matter how it is, then as a matter of law, it's not groundless, it's not in bad faith or brought for the purposes of harassment. So we already have, assuming that that's a correct assumption, we already have the Burke royalty with respect to this type of claims in the Donworth case. And I'm not asking this court to even go as far as Donworth. I'm just asking this court to go to the, I guess, a tougher standard of directed verdict, because this court later on after Donworth in the Splettstosser versus Meyer case said, under the DTPA and 2121 bad faith counterclaim, it's not the directed verdict statute. It's something it's even lesser than that. And the reason we have the lesser standard was articulated in the Donworth case. This court said the lesser standard would discourage, or any lesser standard would discourage legitimately wronged consumers from seeking protection under the Act and from the courts. And we have that same thing here, where you have questionable claims. If you don't have a standard, then it discourages the insurers from going forward and seeking their constitutionally protected rights from the courts.
You're not claiming that an insurer has a constitutionally protected right not to pay a claim.
Absolutely not.
And let an insurer prove that by preponderance of the evidence in court.
I'm saying that an insurer, like any other person or entity in the state of Texas, has a constitutionally protected right to a trial by jury.
But it's up to this court to set the standard of where that arises and where resting on that right constitutes such a breach of the obligations that it's not only a contractual breach but a tort.
The position I'm making is if you have such a huge hammer over any litigant, whether it's a plaintiff under the DTPA or an insurance carrier under the duty of good faith and fair dealing, that it chills and basically put such a huge hammer over them that they cannot exercise the right to the trial by jury, then basically there becomes some infringement.
Have you seen any statistical studies showing that the number of jury trials, cases filed, anything else have materially changed since Arnold? I don't know if workers' comp cases would even be a legitimate measure because
all
of
I can,
the law.
I'm sorry. All I can say is that virtually, I don't know if there's any exceptions, every case I get involving an insurance claim has bad faith. It's that additional hammer that's being held over the head of the insurance carrier. Either you go ahead and pay the claim and you give up your contract rights, or if you insist upon having your day in court, then we're going to have this hammer over your head, and if you lose, it's going to cost you a lot of money.
There's more than just a contractual relationship, though, between an insurance company and an insured. It's a special relationship, and wouldn't that defeat the reason for recognizing a special relationship if we merely hold the parties to the contract rights under these circumstances?
We're not asking the court to hold the parties to the contract rights. The special relation that was created in Arnold and in Aranda basically said that typically, two parties to a contract, one party can say, I'm not going to pay, you got to sue me. And you go and you get a suit and you get a judgment. What they added in Aranda, what this court added in Aranda and in the Arnold case was, it said, you can't take that position. if you're going to take the position going to court and sue me, you've got to have a reasonable basis. And if you don't, then you're going to have a tort suit. But again, we're not asking this court to return to pre-Aranda, to return to pre-Arnold. All we're asking for is that with this tort duty that's already in place, it probably should be in place, that there should be some safeguards and some standards that an insurance company can know that if I deny this claim, then, you know, likely I will be in bad faith or I won't be in bad faith, because right now they don't know.
One last question. This would not be a standard for the jury. You would, this would be a law question for the court?
I believe this would be a law question for the court, just as it is with respect to the bad faith counterclaims under 2121 and the DTPA, just as it is, for example, in legal malpractice. If you're talking about legal appellate malpractice, the question is, would the appeal have won? Theoretically, you could get some lawyers up there and have the lawyers testify, yeah, I think it would have won, or no, I don't think they would have won. But this court and the courts of appeals, Wiesenthal versus Milhouse, have said no. It's a question for the court. Because, again,
I think you've answered the question.
I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from
May it please the court, Mr. Larry Zinn will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, the two questions before the court raised by National Union's application for whether this court ought to adopt the directed verdict standard, and the second one is whether the settlement language forecloses an Aranda action. If you answer yes to either of those questions, you might as well take Aranda off the books. If you answer yes to the first one, you're taking them off the books as to all bad faith cases. If you answer yes to the second one, you're taking it off the books as to all workers' compensation cases. I mean, that's what's at stake here. That's really the issue. Because this directed verdict standard, first of all, is a standard that no worker, injured worker, can hurdle over.
What does our court mean when it said that our holding in Aranda does not mean, is not meant to intimate that an insurer cannot preserve its rights to dispute and have a day in court on a genuinely contested claim?
Yes.
Is that just window dressing?
No, it
or
was.
Can it be applied?
It was the logical extension of the court's standard that it said in Aranda. It didn't say that if you lose a contract action and your underlying claim, that then you're automatically subject to bad faith action.
That just meant that's the what, part of what we tell the jury in determining whether to have it's part of the evidentiary finding the jury makes.
Well, the plaintiff has a hard burden in an Aranda action. The plaintiff has to prove a negative. He has to prove that there was no reasonable basis to deny or delay a claim. If you add on the standard that not only does the plaintiff have to prove that, but he has to prove that the insurance company could produce no evidence of a reasonable basis, then you're requiring the worker to prove two negatives. And the second negative is a negative that it can't prove. Because in almost all cases, when you think about workers' compensation cases, the worker is not going to be able to get a directed verdict. I've been hanging around comp cases for 10, 12 years. There are lawyers in this room who have hung around them for 2 to 3 times that length. I know many members of this court have sat as trial judges presiding over workers' comp cases. searching your memory, and it's a rhetorical question, can you ever remember when you granted a directed verdict on behalf of the worker in a workers' compensation case? Think about it more. Have you ever been faced with a motion for directed verdict in a workers' compensation case? And think about it this, even if no one has even moved in your court for a directed verdict, would you be even ever granted it in a workers' compensation case? Most of the issues in a workers' compensation case involve extent of injury. Well, my goodness, you can get a report from one company doctor to dispute the worker's claim that he was hurt in course and scope, and has perhaps 10 doctors to say, all from the Baylor College of Medicine, that he's been injured in the course and scope. But under the directed verdict standard of this state, that one company doctor or that one insurance company doctor with that one report from that one visit would be enough to defeat a directed verdict. And in fact, that happened in this case.
I hear your argument. Why shouldn't that same standard apply, for instance, to the groundless bad faith or harassment standard of the DTPA defense? why isn't that also the kind of thing that, that by the standard we set up, it makes that defense virtually meaningless? The legislature said there was to be such a defense. So we should leave this to the jury given a, and give them a tough instruction, which is a large hurdle for the proponent of that issue to carry.
I don't think the DTPA groundless action is comparable to an Aranda action. When you think about the basis of an Aranda action, it derives from a confidential relationship between the insurance company and its insured. And it's almost like a fiduciary relationship. That's why we impose
it. If there's a fiduciary relationship, what happens to it when the worker represents that his claim is not work-related? Isn't the insurance company entitled to give that some credence?
The insurance company should determine why the worker, if the worker indeed did that.
He did do it in this case.
Well, I think there are some things to understand about this case. One, this is an occupational injury case. There was no accident. There was no event, one event, what everybody saw. This man worked on a vibrator truck for years. It wore out his back. Second, this man has a ninth grade education. He relies upon his employer. He reports the injury. It's the employer that puts him on disability. In fact, the evidence shows that both he and his supervisor thought they were sending on paperwork for workers' compensation. And in fact, there's some question about whether Justo Dominguez even understood the difference between workers' compensation and disability.
Well, I can understand that and appreciate that. Doesn't the insurance company have to give some credence to what he says?
Yes, and then they should investigate because now the worker's claiming it's work-related, and not only is he claiming it's work-related, but his treating doctor, after several objective tests, has concluded that it's a work-related injury. They also have this medical report. And the only thing contrary to that is the one-day report from Dr. Driscoll, who was the company doctor. So they have a duty then to investigate. And had they investigated this, they would have realized that this was simply a matter of confusion. At best, at worst, it was the employer trying to protect himself from a workers' compensation claim. But at best, this was a situation where the worker was confused and perhaps the employer was confused. We're dealing with an occupational injury. It's not something that you see in terms of an accident. And they knew from day one that this was an occupational injury claim.
Why does the insurance company have to determine that, make, in essence, the same determination the jury would make, at the peril of the possible penalty that it faces, as in this case?
If Your Honor please, I think your premise is wrong. I don't read Aranda to say that if the jury rules in your favor in the underlying case, in this case the worker's favor, that that automatically gives you the bad faith action. The same is true if they rule against you. Although I'll say as a practical matter, you're deeply out of the hunt. You can't win your underlying comp case. I know few lawyers, if any, who would pursue a bad faith action after they've lost their underlying comp case to a jury. But in any case, the premise is wrong. An Aranda action isn't the same as the jury deciding in the underlying comp case. The insurance company has a special duty with regard to its insured. It's in the best position to know what that duty is. It is a large, powerful, economically wealthy corporation that deals in this business every day. They deal with people who are often inexperienced and unknown to the legal system and the insurance business. And because of that, we've imposed this duty upon them, which is no different, in fact, I think, from a duty that we impose on lawyers to their clients, doctors to their patients.
Why is it different from the duty under the DTPA?
Because in the DTPA, it's almost like the DTPA is like a Rule 11 situation in federal court. That's what the DTPA standard is about.
But why is it different?
That doesn't arise out of any special relationship. We're dealing with different policy matters. Rule 11 in federal court, the DTPA standard of groundless action, is an attempt to deal with groundless claims in the litigation system. And whether you agree with how they're exercised, or whether they're rightly done. That's their purpose. It has nothing to do with a confidential relationship or the special business relationship that derives from the insurance company and its insured. The analogy really is more to the lawyer and the client, the doctor and the patient, the accountant to his client, and in those kind of situations, perhaps the trustee to the beneficiary.
Do you think plaintiffs in DTPA cases would think twice about bringing the action if they knew they might be liable for actual punitive damages, including mental anguish, if the action was found to have brought bad things?
Well, we're dealing with tort law in Aranda. Bringing an action where the court system decides it's groundless is not a tort. Punitive damages exist because someone has committed a tort, and they have committed the tort in such a way that society feels that they should be additionally punished for that act. They've committed a wrong in society's eyes. The only wrong committed under the DTPA Act and Rule 11 and other sanctions is that the court system has determined that this case shouldn't have been brought in the court system. That's not a tort.
If it were punished by punitive damages, wouldn't you have grave reservations about bringing it to the first place?
Well, I can tell you this. Every time I file a case in federal court, I say a prayer. Okay?
So it does have deterrent effect.
Because I never know when I might get hit with a Rule 11. And that's the purpose of the DTPA sanction. Although I think that the Rule 11 sanction has been taken too far, but that's another story.
Let me move you to another area that troubles me and tell me why I'm wrong. The elements of the breach of duty, good faith, and fair dealing is that you must show that the insurance company did not have a reasonable basis for denying the claim, and they knew or should have known that they had no reasonable basis for denying the claim. Yet you agreed for the trial court to enter into an agreed judgment when you settled your comp claim that had language to the effect that all such issues regarding the injury and the insurance company's liability, the extent of injuries and the need for future medical services are disputed, indefinite, uncertain, and incapable of being exactly established and determined. Why does that not amount to you pleading yourself out of court for a bad faith claim?
Well, several reasons. When you look at the facts of this case, and if you look at the judgment, this judgment actually contains some X'd out parts. One X'd out part is an entire paragraph in the judgment that said that Justo Dominguez was releasing the insurance company from any claims with regard to their handling of the claim. That was removed from the judgment by X'ing out that paragraph, and that judgment was signed by the court. The actual X'd out judgment is in the court record before you. Also, language that referred to that was X'd out. This was language that was missed. We have evidence in this case from the insurance.
Is that your explanation? You just missed this language?
It was inadvertently left in at best, or at worst was the terms of that language were dismissed by the lawyers. Because we have the evidence from the insurance company lawyer,
whether it was negligence on the lawyer, or inadvertence, whatever, it's still there. And doesn't that negate, as a matter of law, the basis for the bad faith claim?
No. The vehicles for negating that would be such concepts as collateral estoppel or judicial estoppel or equitable estoppel. We don't have collateral estoppel here. The issue wasn't actually litigated. There's no evidence this was actually litigated. In fact, the evidence from the insurance company lawyers, it wasn't even discussed. Plus, not only that, you have the X'd out part of the judgment, which certainly indicates an intent, and that was X'd out by Justo Dominguez's lawyer, and that evidence is an intent not to waive the Aranda action.
Is there any such exculpatory language, I'll call it, for lack of a better word, which has to be included in a workers' compensation settlement, either at the board or at the trial court level?
Under the old act.
Under the old act, there was.
Before the board, it was required, and that was under 8307, section 12.
How about under the current act you're operating?
That language doesn't appear. I went back and looked, though, at the forms under the Texas Workers' Comp Commission when they settle a case before the Benefit Review Board, and there's a part in there where it says the parties agree, and then there's a lot of these blanks. It's not beyond me that the insurance company will be putting that language in those settlement agreements every chance they get.
And that is something that you, the plaintiff and his or her attorney have the right to negotiate.
Yes, and it was negotiated and was taken out. I mean, we have it, the direct language with regard to the Rhonda action was removed from this judgment. Plus, it was not essential to this judgment. This was a case before the trial court. There's a different statute that applies under the old act. The trial court is not required to make that finding. Therefore, it wasn't essential, and so collateral estoppel doesn't apply. Neither does equitable estoppel. Judicial estoppel doesn't apply because the matter wasn't made under oath. Judicial admission doesn't apply because it was made in a separate proceeding and for the other reasons stated in our brief. So we have a situation where that language should not be binding. If it is indeed binding, then what we're really saying is that almost in every compensation case, we're going to have a situation where an Rhonda action is waived because that language appears. And that's particularly important now because if there's one thing clear under the new Workers' Compensation Act, it's that the worker's lawyer has no role in that process. We have a situation now under workers' compensation where the worker is now standing alone against the insurance company. This is a different situation than the court faced in 1988 when it decided Rhonda. What the court said then is even more important now with regard to protecting the injured working men and women of Texas because they have less protection under the new act. And in fact, they don't even have their lawyer available. So we have more potential for abuse, both in terms of handling the claims and in terms of the settlement language. That's why your decision in this case is so important in terms of future actions, in terms of protecting injured working men and women of Texas. And I just say one more thing about that. I know of no more vulnerable part of our society than injured men and women who have families. They're in a bind. They need the money. They'll make compromises. They'll do things they normally wouldn't do. Under our current system, they don't even, as a practical matter, have access to a lawyer. If you take away a Rhonda by ruling in National Union's favor in this case, you're going to be taking away one of the last protections that injured men and women of Texas have.
We did not have a Rhonda until 1988. Did it really make that much difference?
Oh, I think it did. You have no idea the abuses that were occurring in the system for decades. I mean, TEIA, which was the largest workers' comp carrier in Texas, was an absolute disaster area when it came to paying off claims fairly and equitably. Had they been subject to a Rhonda, there is no telling the amount of mental anguish and hurt that injured men and women of Texas would have been spared had we had a Rhonda earlier than it did. I can't prove that to you with statistics.
No economic studies or sociological studies or anything else about the difference that Arnold and Rhonda has made in the practice of law and in the practice of insurance companies and in the lives of Texans.
I can't put it in statistics. I can just speak from experience and from talking with others and from what I've seen. And I can only leave, you know, the Israelis said there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. So I'm not sure what statistics would really help the court in that sense. But I certainly know from experience that injured men and women in Texas who were hurt on the job had a terrible, terrible time trying to collect their benefits before Rhonda. Unless the court has questions.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
First off, there should be no confusion. We are not trying to eliminate Rhonda. That is not our intent. That is not what we're asking the court to do. With respect to collateral estoppel, a couple of points. One is the point that this was not actually litigated. I would point this court to its decision in Employers Casualty versus Block, 1988, Ex parte Garina, 1979, which said this court held that an agreed judgment entered into by parties has collateral estoppel effect. So that argument is incorrect. Second, was it essential to the judgment? Did the court have to include this language in there? 8307 section 12 requires that in hearings for the board that this language be included. And one of the reasons is if the worker is going to compromise his position and his benefits, then the liability ought to be indefinite, uncertain, and incapable of being exactly determined. If it's not, then there should be no compromise approved by the board of the worker's benefits.
So your position is the board cannot approve any settlement if there is a, and this is going to be a pending bad faith claim.
Well, if the board should not approve any settlement if the liability is not indefinite and capable of being determined, except for the full amount. That's correct.
And there can never be a bad faith claim if the board approves a settlement.
If the board approves a settlement, because it is, and again, before the board can approve a settlement, it's indefinite and capable of being exactly determined, then that would be correct. As far as it applying to the district court, Rule 820 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure basically say that the practices and procedures before the IAB are made applicable to the district courts in the state of Texas. So it's our position that was required by the court. If you look at the decision by the Houston court at Angelina Casley versus Bennett, which we cited in their brief, they held that it was essential. Also, Price versus TBI.
Your position is that the trial court had to include this language.
That's right.
Had no choice.
That's right. Unless the other choice the trial court had was if the liability was not indefinite and capable of being exactly determined, it shouldn't approve the assembly. They were suing for total and permanent disability. And if indeed the worker was totally and permanently disabled, the trial court should not have approved the settlement.
Again, no case can be settled and preserve a bad faith claim.
If you're settling for less than the amount that the worker is seeking for, I agree with that. I agree
can
with
you
that.
Give a that's statutory that. Reference to that point?
8307, Section 12 under the old statute.
Right. How about under the new statute?
I don't have a new statute. Then I had Rule 820 under the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, which required or basically takes the rules of procedure before the IAB and implements them to the district courts in the state of Texas.
But one of the rules of law that you're asking this court to make clear has the effect of assuring no settlements either at the board level or at the trial court level that would preserve a bad faith claim.
Again, under the new statute, I'm not aware of whether it's
dealing with the old statute.
Old statute, correct. If it was a compromise of the worker's position, if he's taking less than he would be entitled to, then the court's required to make this determination, and I think that would be correct. I agree with that statement. Now, second, the question is, well, what about judicial estoppel or judicial admissions? We have more than just this particular statement that was contained in the judgment. The worker in this case testified at the trial of this case that the liability of National Union was disputed, indefinite, uncertain, and incapable of being exactly determined. And that statement was true when he signed the judgment back in June 1st of 1988. It was true at the time of trial. He never rebutted. He never came off that testimony. He never tried to rehabilitate himself. That was left basically there, undisputed. We also believe that that would be judicial admission on the part of the claimant as well.
Any questions?
The law is set forth in Biles and Rhonda and Arnold. Insofar as it goes, you applaud.
I agree. Well, as far as Arnold is concerned, I agree with the concept and the rules that are set forth in Rhonda. That is correct. It's the implementation that we have a problem with.
And Biles, which you cited to the court this morning.
Correct.
And Aranda.
Aranda, right, in Arnold. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments of the court for today. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Please rise. Oh, yay. Oh, yay. Oh, yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.